Hello again, everyone, and welcome. This is Julie Knutson with podcast number 65 of Training the Pointing Labrador. And we're going to be emphasizing the Pointing Labrador things here today. This is going to be listener questions because I've gotten a lot of them and very common themes amongst several of them. So, and most of them have something to do with the more recent wool breaking series of podcasts that I had. So people are having some questions and problems. So I don't know whether it was that I didn't explain things clearly enough, or there's just so much stuff and it's easy to miss things. But I'm going to go back and go over just a few things and why some people are having problems. I've gotten videos and I've gotten stories where people are telling me, you know, all the ways that they can put their dog in a standing position. And, they're showing various things that they're doing, walking around in circles and shooting guns and, you know, putting them in front of the chickens or in front of some birds or bringing birds to them. And yet when they go out on the upland field and they go on point, they only hold it for just a little bit and then they go ahead and move in on the bird. And so everyone's kind of confused. And there's two approaches, maybe more, but there's two fundamentally different approaches to this whole wool breaking stuff. And one is the one that works with a lot of the pointing breeds. And it's a very, very strict. It's very effective with those kind of dogs and with the right kind of dogs. I would call it kind of a fear-based thing. In other words, once you say whoa, they know they're done. And it's similar to the way that we retriever people do the stop on a whistle. Most of us, it's when we blow that stop whistle, you're gonna sit. It doesn't matter whether you're treading water or you're sitting on a sticker or you don't like where you're sitting, you're going to drop that bottom. And so when people wool break that way, and there's, you know, lots of ways to show you how to do that. When you wool break that way, then once you hear whoa or find out where that applies, it's pretty absolute and they don't move. So that's always an option. You know, it's kind of woe or die, just like we do sit or die. I found that to do both of them can be confusing. And also to do that strong of something on a bird, that can really affect some dogs in a negative way. So that's why I haven't gone that way with it. And that's why I tell people, I don't tell them how to do that because I don't do that. I have a little bit and just, you know, it just wasn't my deal. But on a sit whistle, man, my dog's better sit, I'll tell you that. But that's real easy and they understand it. And they don't associate it with the retrieve or anything else. And so it doesn't detract from any particular style and stuff like that. And I'll say those pointer guys, they can do the heavy wool break and not mess with the style on these hard charging fire breathing dragons. They can do that. It's just beautiful. So I give them all the credit in the world. A lot of us are not capable of doing that. The other approach, and the one I'm talking about, is to change their thinking. And to go through the motions of the things that I describe is not changing their thinking. So to a lot of people who have told me, oh, I can put them in the chicken pen, I can put them in the bird pen, and they don't do anything. And I've said, I think I said it in the book and I've said it on my deal, just because they can go stand in there and look at all these birds, if you look at what they're thinking while they're doing this, that tells you a lot. So I can take my guys that are new to this, you know, and I've got them where I can wool them outside and shoot and do all kinds of stuff. And then I take them in there to introduce, it isn't finishing it off. It is to introduce, all right, when you see birds and stuff walking around and smell birds and flapping of wings and things like that, you still don't move because they will stand in there and do that. Does not in any way mean that this is a wool broken dog or that this is a dog that will not out in the field not have its desire to get the bird overcome any notion of what it is you wanted it to do, you know, and they're going to go get the birds. So it's that little element that seems to be problematic to understand. So I'm going to take everybody back a little bit on this particular thing. So where we want to change their thinking, right? We're not going to scare them to death and go, holy cow, I'm never going to move. That's an option, you know, and with some dogs, maybe that's a better thing to do. But what we want to do is first teach them, right? The whole first one was teach them to stand there. Whether you're moving away or close, to stand there. Okay, that's step one. It has absolutely nothing to do with upland hunting, nothing to do with birds. It just is a thing where they learn to stand still without regard to where you're standing or what you're doing. So that's a big deal. Then the next step is you teach them to do that kind of thing and resist a lot of temptation. So when you give them the hup, hup, get it, you know, shooting stuff, throwing it right in front of them, if they don't push back, if they're still going, oh, I really want to get that, okay, then they're really wanting to get that. In other words, you know, I told you, everybody, it's what they're thinking. We're trying to change their thinking. So when their thinking is, oh, I want that, okay, we're not where we need to be. We need to be, when you're doing all that stuff, they're looking at you going, when are you going to stop? This is unpleasant. You know, I don't like this anymore. When are you going to stop? And they're not sitting there going, oh, God, I really wish I could go get that. That's a really important part of this. So when you do some tempting things, whatever that is, you know, if you're shooting a gun, if you just shoot a gun all by itself, that does not mean they're steady to a gun. It means they're steady to a gun in the yard that you're shooting. It does not mean that when a big old pheasant comes up and you drop it and that poof of feathers goes out, that they aren't going to break. That's a totally different thing. So all you are doing when you first are shooting guns or throwing things or giving contrary cues like hup hup or get it, when you're doing that, we're beginning to teach them that when something tempting happens, that it not to engage with that. As a matter of fact, to just sort of shut it out. And that takes time and repetition. It also takes, depending on your dog, a pretty high level of temptation. And I had a dog in here recently where the owners had already done a pretty good job of wool breaking their dog. I got one of their dogs before, and they told me it was wool broken. So I was doing my wool stuff, and I put my hand down over its head and told, and I was filming this for him, and told the dog to get it, and it did. Just took off and went after it. So, you know, I said, well, no, we're not wool broken. It stands under certain conditions and not under others. So I get another dog from them, and I did that when I got it. It's like, all right, let's do the get it thing. Dog didn't move at all. But all I did, I was in front of the dog, and I'm looking at her going, I want to find, and I, as the trainer now, I want to find what's going to make this dog disengage from woe and move. And I did gun things and all kinds of stuff that I do. And I stood in front of her and tapped my thighs. Here she came, just like that. And I said, whoa, first, right? Whoa. And then I just tapped my thighs, you know, like I was this loving dog owner. And here she came. So was this dog woe broken? No. Because woe was not an absolute thing. So when you think you have it, now your job as the trainer of this dog is to find out where it is you do not have it. Because if there is anything you can do that makes that dog, after you tell it whoa, remember, be fair. Don't just do all kinds of stuff and say nothing. Tell the dog whoa and then shoot your thing, do your stuff. Tell him get it. A non-force command. And just see what happens. Okay, so that's a thing that that people really miss is, look, it'll do this and this, good, next step. And so they rush on, and they still have that dog's mind wanting to, you know, oh, I like that, oh, I want to go, and find out where they do go. Now, the other part of this that's important is that the consequence for breaking a clearly understood command, and I'm going to put woe is going to go into the force commands like sit and hear and fetch, right? Those are commands that you enforce strongly with training pressure. You enforce those things so that when you say them, you back it up and you mean it. You know, other stuff is not some mark, you know, watch it or whatever, hunt it up. Those aren't force commands. But if you tell a dog to fetch, you know, they have to fetch. And if you tell them to sit, they have to sit. And so the same thing goes with whoa. You, when you say whoa, they have to whoa. So not only do you teach them all of these things that you have to do, now you have to go enforce it. And there has to be a consequence when the dog breaks whoa. So, and I discussed that, I believe, in the second or third of the whoa breaking things. All right, and then when they don't break, then I force them to break so that I can give them a consequence for breaking. Now that, right, that's not entirely fair, but I have to show this dog that when I say whoa, it really, really means it. So this isn't, even though I say this is the nicer guy approach, it's not a unicorns and flowers. There has to be a consequence for breaking whoa. And just unceremoniously putting them back for the vast majority of dogs is not enough of a consequence. And so I discussed in great detail the collar consequence I have. It can't be a high, hard one because that's what we use for sitter here. It has to be a different thing. But there has to be a consequence that they do not want again. And you can't do it once or twice because that doesn't really, really fully embed any kind of behavior. You have to do it and not in a period of weeks. Right? This has to kind of become a way of life. And you have to find ways where you can enforce this so that it becomes second nature to them when they hear the whoa command to push back and not do anything. So what I want anyone that's, if you haven't done the more advanced training, if you haven't don't have a dog that has been forced to the pile and forced on the double T, not just baseball diamond stuff where they run out there and get stuff because they like to, but I mean where they've been forced and forced to go and then forced to stop. Right? And if you haven't done that, then you're not going to understand what I'm saying. But if you have, through the correct program, when you blow that sit whistle, there is no question what your expectation is. Absolutely no question. And you will enforce at whatever level you have to where that dog sits when you blow the whistle. And it doesn't matter, again, land, water, you have to put them through the water, the swim-by thing as well, where they learn, wow, when they blow that whistle, I turn around and I sit down or tread water and I wait. And it's absolute. There's no place where you go, well, you know, that bird, that duck flew by, and so that's why they, you know, again, then they're not always going to sit, and you have this kind of wimpy program for that stuff. So you've got to approach the whoa in exactly the same way. You know, you're going to make that dog sit on a whistle even if they're at a dead run 250 yards away from you. So you have to make this dog know that... Oops, sorry about that. Small dog pan washing interruption in the middle of that. In any case, you have to get right back to that, you have to approach whoa the same way. It has to be absolute, and there has to be a consequence. And you have to practice it, not just a little bit for a few weeks or once or twice or until, good, I got it, because we don't do that in the other stuff, and it doesn't work here. So just because you can take your dog into a chicken pen or a bird pen or bring birds to it or whatever, just because you can do that and the dog's standing there tolerating this activity does not mean when they go out in the field and engage with that bird that they're going to tolerate the fact you said, well, they're going to just screw that and throw it out and do whatever they want because they have not been conditioned. that, golly, when this person says, whoa, I'm really done, and I don't want to test it and challenge it. So that's a big part of it. I've often told people, I think whoa takes really some months, assuming the dog's mature enough. And it's much easier to get on a dog that you've put through the yard. And by that, I mean, you know, dogs that will sit on a whistle and do all the advanced stuff, assuming that you have, you know, laid down the law on that stuff. Then when you lay down the law over here doing your woe drills, then they can out in the field be held to the same standard. So if you think about it, for those of you that handle, when you're going through the T, and again, this isn't the nice guy, you know, kind of baseball-y diamond, oh good, they run out there and they kind of stop. I mean, when you forced them and forced them to go and you forced them to stop, then when you start running your sight blinds and pattern blinds and men begin cold blinds, right? This is a months long kind of thing. Right? It's not something, you know, in 3 weeks, we're ready to hit the big leagues. It takes a long time, but your standard doesn't change, right? After you've been through the yard and you've gone through the, first you force them to go, and then we teach them to stop, and then we make them stop, and then we enforce the stop. I suspect, at least I certainly hope, when you're out running blind retrieves with these dogs and you blow the whistle, that every single time, you make sure that dog stops. Now, you don't, think about this, guys. You don't come off the tee, you know, where you force and then where you teach to stop and teach them to stop and take overs or stop them multiple times. You don't jump from that, right into running cold blinds, past the flyer station, under the arc of the fall, all that kind of stuff. You don't jump into that. There is a mental transition in which this dog is taught, all right, now you know to go and stop. Now I'm going to give you some conditions under which you are going to have to go and stop that you can understand. And as they understand sight blinds, places where they know where this stuff is, and then, you know, then you get some pattern blinds, and then you begin to teach, you know, all the different ways that you can, I'm not going to go into all that stuff, but you ease them into the behavior in the field before you throw them off the cliff and we're going to run a blind downwind of the flyer station just past it or under the arc of the flyer or whatever. That's a lot to get there so the dog keeps it all in context. And if you think about it, it's very similar to a woe-broken dog because in the yard you teach them, and hopefully very thoroughly, so that they now have pushback whenever there's temptation. You can't just jump right out there into the upland field and boom, start enforcing it and have them fully and clearly understand it because they probably don't. So you have to be aware of your dog's ability to grasp what you're asking, grasp the application, and you know, not just jump right in there. You don't wanna, and I'm gonna go back to the handling thing. So you've gone through the tee and your dog goes on back and stops and takes overs or takes a right back or a left back and they do all that. They understand it there, right? They really understand it and they kind of are comfortable and they can do it. So now if you just jump right out into where you're doing a set of marks and go, I'm going to run a blind over there, right? They're going to run over to one of the marks. They don't even know there's such a thing as a blind out there. And now you're handling them and they're not taking the cast and now they're getting crazy and upset and they're not stopping and you wonder what's wrong with this crazy dog. And that's because there's no context and they don't know, gosh, those blinds you ran, there's things like that too, only this time you don't know where they are and there's other stuff. It's just so complicated. So when you woe break a dog, you have to give them increasing context. And you can't just go out in the upland field and go, all right, I woe broke you, sucker, so you better do everything right. Because again, if they've spent their youth out there pointing and busting birds, you know, the de-chasing can happen fairly soon. But that doesn't make them always just be a staunch pointer. Some it does. The majority it doesn't. They still get carried away with their aggressive and high desire for birds. So you can't just go out there, just like you can't run cold blinds off the tee, and you can't go out in the upland field and go, all right, buddy, you're not going to move. So you've got to understand that they've got to learn this a little bit, and you do that by doing upland work, maybe in less exciting things. You use some chucker. You don't always shoot them when they make a mistake. You don't always, and again, this is tough. You don't always, you don't go out there with the collar and correct them necessarily on birds. But you, when they go out there and totally blow you off on your woe stuff, then you know that you've got to go back, not in the field, in my opinion. You've got to go back and make that woe word carry a whole lot more weight. Just like the sit whistle, you do whatever it takes on a dog that handles to make them understand when I blow that sit whistle, all things are done. And you have to go back, not in the field where they associate it with that bird, but in other ways where you're doing your woe stuff and teach them this word carries as much weight as that sit whistle. Without, you know, again, I don't like it associated with live birds a whole lot, unless it's like a bird pin situation or they're on woe and I bring my little string of birds, you know, then I'll get after them like heck, because we didn't hunt those up. I'm very careful about doing it with most dogs, not all, but most dogs out in the field. So that's the problem that a lot of people are having. I have it myself with some of the dogs I have right now. I have some real good pointers. You know, and I've been working woe, and they're still going to go out there after a little while if something, the wrong leaf moves or somebody steps in the wrong place, which tells me, you know, my woe stuff is by all means not done. And I can't go in a week and get it done either, because this is a process, and it is a mental process with the dog. Unless you got one of those hard chargers where you can just really crush them and they're still going to be fine. The vast majority of us do not have those dogs. So that's something that's very important. Now, another thing, some of the other questions that I've gotten as the test season is now on, I hope that answers the woe stuff, because that's a non-trivial thing. It really is. And if you don't have your dog de-chased, then you got two things going at once. So you need to get the de-chase going in there. And then you've really got to understand your dog's mentality, and you've got to do retriever type training on these guys to make it absolute. So the other things are getting ready for tests. And last year, I think I went through a whole series of how to get ready for various tests and ways to prepare yourself. But there's one thing that I've had a lot of questions on, and I really want to go into this, and that is just the first 20 or 30 seconds if you're running an event. So people get very, very nervous. People who have done this for a long time get very, very nervous. And people that are doing it for the first time or one of the first few times, or who have a lot of ego and vanity, they're the worst, because they'll tell you they have no ego and vanity in it, and that's all they've got. And it's really hard for them, but it's hard for them to ask for help as well. But people get very nervous. So whatever venue of dog thing you are running, I'm not going to go through the stuff I did last year. That's all available on here. But whatever you're going through, one of the biggest mistakes that I see people make, new people and not new people, is they're talking a lot. They're talking a lot. And I know a lot of people that tell people not to talk a lot as they're talking a lot. So, I mean, seriously, just watch things that are happening. Before you ever run an event, I don't care if it's a started or a junior hunter or certification or the highest level of everything, find out, one, what the rules are. That would be very good. They are all available online. I wouldn't necessarily listen to anybody. If you have a good pro or a really good amateur that doesn't talk a lot and knows this stuff, listen to them. But most of all, go and read what the rules are. Find out, you know, where are you under judgment? Most of the time you're under judgment, even on the beginning stuff, from the holding blind to the line. Find out what defines the line. Find out what you're allowed to say or not say. Find out what you're allowed to wear or not wear. All of that is available. And then, so know that stuff. You know, different venues have different, you know, some let you, in the beginning stuff, wear a flat collar. Some do not. Some let no electric collars ever. Some of them have, you can have a slip lead. Some you can have a choke chain. Stay as close as you can to what you do when you're training. So I use chuck chains with a little short tab. That's what I use. I don't like flat collars with leashes because that's just an Iditarod pull thing. So I'm not saying this is what you should do. I'm just saying this is what I do. I use choke chains and make them have really good obedience 100% of the time. And we go to the line that way. And then and if you can't have a choke chain, then I have a choke chain that's held as a just a slip lead kind of a deal. But I try to stay as consistent with what their every day of training is like. If I go to an event and suddenly I do everything differently, then everything is different in the dog's mind. And then I might get very different kind of behaviors and responses from this dog because stuff has changed. So stay as true to what you do every day. Be consistent in what you do every day. Know what the rules are. In a lot of these, in the HRC stuff, you have to shoot a gun. In AKC stuff, you have a non-shooting gun that you must shoulder and act as if you are. And so gun safety is required by all of these people. And so if you are not comfortable with handling a shotgun, then go get yourself a cutoff broom handle or do something. This is a killing piece of equipment. It is a killing piece of equipment. And death comes out of one end of it. So be aware that you have death coming out of one, even if it's your broom handle. It, don't point it at the ground. Don't take it from the sky to the ground because you're passing by somebody. Learn from someone who is very good at this stuff. I'm not going to give a gun safety lecture. We had some recently at a training session. We were teaching people, and it was swinging around, and we're all jumping on the ground. It's just a wooden gun. But, you can get thrown out for that stuff. So before you go do an event that you have to exhibit good gun safety and gun handling, practice it. Practice it with an umbrella that death comes out one end, okay, because that's what it is. You could shoot somebody with a gun. And so treat this thing like that. And learn what the good handling is. And then make sure that you are comfortable with that stuff before you get to the line. So you're not too worrying about, what do I do with this gun thing? And then what do I do? What are the rules? When can I say? Hey, don't worry. You need to get all of this in your head first, particularly gun safety, folks. This whole game is under attack by people who are against the use of animals and guns and all that stuff. And so whether you agree with it or don't agree with it, I don't care about that. As long as we're doing this, let's not give anybody any reason to go, look at that. That stuff is not good. Look at these people. So extreme gun safety as if this was a life or death matter, because really it is. Okay, so practice that stuff first, all you guys that have to handle guns, until it becomes second nature. If you have to stand in your living room or your basement or your back porch and practice walking to the line and shouldering and shooting and all that and do it 100 times, then do that, okay? Do that until when you go to the line with this gun situation and you have to sit on something or stand up or do whatever you have to do, that you don't have to think about handling this death thing that you have in your hand. That it is second nature to do the correct thing, and that all of your focus can be on your dog and giving it every opportunity to do the best job it can. So there are no excuses if you're whatever you're running for you not to practice and practice and practice that. And if you don't have somebody around you who is extremely knowledgeable at that or good at teaching, then there's YouTube videos that you can go and watch what you're supposed to do. But most of all, go practice it. Because to do this right takes muscle memory. I don't care how smart you are. I don't care what a great memory you have and somebody can tell you something and you can get it one time. This is not that kind of thing. This is a muscle memory thing. And so the best thing you can do is practice, go through the motions, have your invisible dog, and practice it over and over until it becomes second nature before you go do this. And you will be very glad that you did. And I'm going to say again, remember, this is a death machine that you have in your hand. And I don't care if it's a stick. You treat it with the respect, because you have to do that until it becomes second nature. So when you are running in your event and you do have a gun in your hand, and maybe it has poppers in it, or maybe you don't even have to shoot it, but those people judging you expect you to treat that like you are out hunting and shooting, and nobody wants to be with you if you're going to accidentally shoot somebody or something. So that's a practice thing to do that's very important. That's the beginning. That's walking from the holding blind to the line, whatever it is that you have to do. Do it safely. Know where you're going to put your leash or your whatever you've got on your dog that you're taking off, because that cannot be hanging around flapping. You can't have training equipment visible and present while you're running your dog. Have a nice big pocket in something where you can put it there and continue to operate your dog. Go through your mind how you're going to receive the dog. All right, what are you going to do? What are you going to say? Are you going to talk and make them nervous? Or are you going to do what's best for the dog? Okay, lots of talking is not good. It's not good, just like it wouldn't be for you. If you were learning how to drive and somebody was just constantly telling you everything to do, you'd go nuts. So same thing with your dog. Say only what's necessary, nothing more. Don't make them any more nervous than they're going to be reflecting yours. Practice between birds, practice everything you're going to do, practice running blinds in your head. What casts would I give? Would I take a step? Would I not take a step? You know, am I going to give a verbal? Am I going to not give a verbal? Get all of that in your head first. And really, most of all, create muscle memory by practicing. I know it sounds crazy, but it's really important, particularly if you're new, and also if you're not new. But if you don't have this already, it's very, very important. Okay, now I got to go to some puppy stuff. So I've had a few questions on, and this will be my last one. We're kind of going on and on here. I've had a few questions on some puppy things. And it's interesting because some dogs are early developers. Some dogs are not early developers. Within a litter, you may have a wide variety. And, you know, within an individual, they may change a lot. So we've had a lot of puppies this spring. Everybody's out and about. And one of the things that I see that, and I get a lot of questions, oh, look at this dog is doing this, and mine is not doing that, and mine is doing this. And first thing you get is everybody telling you what to do. Any of you guys with puppies, you have an expert or two or 10 around you, and everyone's telling you, you know, what you're doing is wrong, or do what I do. I would say what I want people to understand, I can't tell you everything to do with them. Get a good program, get a trusted person. That has a nice process through which you go with this dog. But I think it's very important for people to understand that just like kids, everyone progresses at a different rate, and everybody has different strengths and different weaknesses. Dogs are not, if I could, in all of these podcasts, if I could get one thing through to everybody, if I could get one thing out there that would make a difference, it is that these guys are not programmable robots. They do not, you just go and you get them, and I suffer this a lot. I get people that give me their dogs. I have some of the best clients in the world. But I get people, you know, they send me a dog, and I'm supposed to get A, B, C, D, E, F, G done. Because after all, I'm supposed to know what I'm doing, and here's a dog. And it doesn't always work that way. Dogs are not here to be programmed. And if you're a good, reasonable trainer, or you have a good, reasonable trainer, their job is to figure that dog out and do the optimal thing for that dog. So there are dogs out there who are very high intelligence and very low energy. And you have dogs that are very high energy and very high intelligence. They're dangerous because they're probably ahead of you. Then there are dogs with high energy and very low intelligence. And they're not fun because they move a lot and they never they don't get a lot of progress. And you have dogs that are very, attention deficit, which is not an excuse. It is means that you have to make adjustments and still require good things out of them. People just use that, oh, they get easily distracted. That's an excuse. You have to work with dogs and teach them, have them acquire the ability to focus. You have dogs that are, they have some of the mental conditions that kids have. There are a lot of dogs out there who, with very much stimulus, kind of shut down. So people think they're stupid or stubborn. That's usually what I hear. And some dogs are not smart, and some dogs are a little bit hard-headed about changing their ways. That's true. But there are also, and I've seen more and more of it over time, dogs that with a lot of stimulus can no longer function. And so those are the dogs that get pounded on a lot and shocked and yelled at and thrown at, and people are very frustrated. And I can't imagine what it's like to be that dog. So if I could just get people to know that sometimes there are autistic kind of dogs. I'm no expert in autism. Only what I've seen and read a little bit. So please, I am not an expert. But there are dogs whose interaction with the external world is different from what we expect or different from what we're used to. And that doesn't mean they can't function out as we would like. They can't be hunters and good pets and stuff like that. But it means that the way that you're going to communicate with them and educate them is going to be different. But if you cannot change how you do it, then you and this dog are not going to work together. And it, you know, sometimes that's okay for the dog, and sometimes it's very not okay for the dog. So there are many dogs that do not see the world the way that we think they do. And so if you can just be aware that sometimes it's that way, and maybe be a little bit more open-minded. There's the dog's ability to understand what you're asking. And sometimes if you have, and this is hard to explain, you might have a very intelligent dog, but you are operating at a slower or more rudimentary level than that dog thinks, then that dog's going to look kind of crazy. Or if you have kind of a normal, regular dog and you are treating it like it's kind of a dog Einstein, right? Now the dog is going to not look very good as well, even though it's just a fine dog. So how you like to teach, how you like to think of a dog, and particularly if you're very proud of what a good dog trainer you are, that's a kiss of death. If somebody tells you how good they are, that really concerns me, because it's very humbling to be a dog trainer, because every time you think you got something and then they point out that you don't, then you realize how far you are from being pretty good. And so it's a very humbling thing. So as you approach these puppies and, you know, you paid a bunch of money and the other guy's is doing this and yours isn't. Or yours is and his isn't, so his isn't very good, or him. When you get all of these kind of comparisons and putting pressure on yourself or the dog, this isn't good enough, or I'm so much better, there's a humble comment on that one. Be aware that you are part of the limiting factor and the dog is part of the limiting factor. And you have to, as a dog trainer, figure out what the dog is, and then also what you are. So it's very, very important. And sometimes the problems that we have with dog training, and I'm speaking from personal experience, is because we're not on the same page. We're not on the same wavelength. It doesn't mean that I'm not a good trainer. It doesn't mean this dog isn't a good dog. It's just that right now we're on two different air things. And the dog is just looking at me like, oh gosh, you know, here you come. This isn't going to be good. And I'm looking at the dog going, oh God, here I come. This isn't going to be very good. And it's not. So if you can, a lot of you with these little dogs, oh, they're doing this and that. You can ship them off to somebody if you want, you know, that way you can kind of just avoid the pay for someone else to take care of the problem and hope they're good enough. Or you can at least kind of sit back, take the judgment, take the expectation, and take the pressure off, and go, let me see exactly what this little guy is. And be aware, not only are they smart and not smart, and kind of hard-headed and kind of not, and kind of, you know, motivated and some are not, there's also other things, just like there are with people. Stimulation can bother them. Your mood, they completely absorb. And then you're mad at them because they're grumpy. So, because you're grumpy. And so find out to the best of your ability what makes the little dog tick. You know, what makes them do best, open up the most, and what, you know, does the opposite of that. Figure that stuff out. Figure how you factor into that. Now, this stuff is not easy. That's why it's not written. And most people who are good with this do it on an intuitive level, not really a thought out level. So they can't tell you, you know, everyone just has labels. Oh, that's hard headed. Oh, that's this, that's that. And they don't really sit back. There's a lot more than just hard headed. Okay, it could be a dog that just shuts down when it's overwhelmed and you're overwhelming it all the time. It's not hard-headed at all. It's just overwhelmed. So I encourage on behalf of all those little dogs out there that are, you know, not always doing exactly what they're supposed to take look at your part. You're 80% of this. The dog's 20 sometimes, unless you have a real problematic dog. Sit back, take a deep breath, and do for this puppy what you would like to be done for you if you were sent to some really hard school to learn some really hard stuff. And if you had a teacher that really saw you and found out what made you tick, you'd love them to death and do anything for them. So see if you can kind of do that with your dog and kind of tune out all the experts around you and get you both on the same page. And then kind of go down the road at the speed that you should, doing the things that you believe are right. And you might be surprised what a learning experience it'll be for both of you. So I haven't been around here a lot lately because it is now test season. And so pressure's on, lots of people, lots of things. I haven't been able to get to everybody's questions and stuff as much as they'd like, and I'm sorry about that, but, you know, I gotta earn my living. And I got college graduations, yay, and a lot of things going on, and my Ironman's coming up in just a few weeks, so I'm kind of terrified of that thing, too. And it's a busy time. I will get back here as soon as I can. I appreciate your questions and your input and your feedback. Very much appreciated, and thank you to all the people that took time to say some nice things. And I wish everybody the very best with their dogs, and I'll be back soon.